Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Akmal Dawi. He's digital managing editor of VOA's Afghan service and VOA corruption correspondent Jeffrey Young. Our guest on this edition of the program is Sarah Chase. She's author of the recently published book, Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. Sarah is also a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That's a think tank here in Washington. Sarah Chase arrived in Afghanistan as a journalist, but the rampant corruption she encountered there drove her to stay for years afterward, fighting for change. Corruption touched every corner of daily life in the country, from crossing police checkpoints to paying utility bills. A bribe was required to accomplish almost anything. Sarah Chase discovered that this was breeding deep anger and resentment among the Afghan people. Now the foreign policy expert has an urgent warning based on what she's learned. Corruption can plant the seeds of violent religious extremism. We see it happening worldwide, from the spread of the self-described Islamic State in Iraq and Syria to Boko Haram in Nigeria to the East-West standoff in Ukraine. On this edition of Press Conference USA, we'll talk with Sarah Chase about how political corruption threatens global security and what can be done about it. Sarah Chase joins us from a studio at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Carol.
And I'm delighted to welcome my distinguished panel, VOA colleagues, Akmal Dawi and Jeffrey Young. Well, Sarah, first, congratulations on your most timely and excellent book.
Thank you.
Now, you say that acute corruption is at the root of some of the world's most dangerous security challenges, that it is, in fact, the cause or a cause of global instability and violent extremism. And, of course, we know that the White House had a summit on this topic this month. Why do you draw a link between kleptocracy, this political corruption, and violent extremism?
You're right to use the word a. I'm not claiming that corruption is the one and only cause, obviously, of the emergence of some of the jihadi, the violent extremist groups that we've been seeing in the last decade or so, or the only cause of the revolutions that have swept, you know, not just Arabic-speaking countries, but Ukraine, but Kyrgyzstan also in the last several years. But I think it's a very important driver and an under-recognized one. And the link that I've been seeing specifically with violent extremism goes like this. One aspect of corruption that Westerners tend to underestimate is how personally humiliating it is in a country like Afghanistan, in a country like Nigeria, in a country like Ukraine. This isn't only, you know, the siphoning off of public funds unbeknownst to citizens who suffer the repercussions, but not directly. This is corruption that literally you encounter every single day. And it's not just the police officer or the nursery school teacher shaking you down for, you know, a little bribe. They do it with a kind of disdain, a kind of contempt that's wounding to a person's dignity just as much as it's wounding to their economy, right? Mm-hmm. And so it makes people angry. And when you have a violent extremist movement right nearby, you know, the fifth or sixth time that you get shaken down by a police officer by the side of the road, you have an insurgency telling you, hey, here's a Kalashnikov, shoot the guy. And not only does it offer you the opportunity to shoot the guy, it says it's right to shoot the guy. And it gives you an explanation. It says the reason that police officer or that government official is robbing you is because he, and it's usually he, because he's not part of a pious government. If only our government were more religiously strict, if only our government obeyed religious law, it could never perpetrate the kinds of crimes against its own people that this government is perpetrating against you. And the other thing I found that was really interesting is we're obviously concerned here in Washington primarily with today's Muslim extremism. But as I researched Thieves of State, I found that this correlation between acute lapses in public integrity and militant puritanical religion, it's not just an Islam thing, and it's not just a 21st century thing. I found a very similar reflex going all the way back to the 16th century and the Protestant Reformation, which when you start reading the documents, you find it's a violent puritanical reaction against very severe corruption, particularly in the Catholic Church, which had a real governing role back then. So it's a thread in human history. It's a reflex that we sometimes have that says, you know, the only way to get responsible and honest public officials is by way of strict private morality.
Indeed. And of course, we know from the example of either the Taliban in Afghanistan or the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria that this is indeed a false dichotomy, because, of course, their version of piety or whatever is certainly extremely violent and perhaps equally corrupt.
That's right. But I think that in the West, there's a tendency to focus on how evil and horrible and sadistic these movements are. And I don't think we pause enough to ask ourselves, if that's the case, why are they so successful in gaining recruits or gaining territory? And if we don't understand why their argument has resonance with people, I don't think there's ever going to be, you know, a successful campaign to curb their activities.
Indeed, you're absolutely right. Let me turn to my colleague Akmal Dawi for a question or comment.
Sarah, you have done an amazing work on corruption in Afghanistan, and as we know, it's an open secret that Afghanistan has one of the most corrupt states on earth. We also have these periodic reports by the Special Inspector General of the U.S. Government for the Reconstruction of Afghanistan, which often comes up with reports saying millions of dollars were wasted on development projects in Afghanistan. We have Transparency International reporting, ranking Afghanistan as one of the most corrupt states. But to me, what amazes me is that little is being done, whether from the U.S. side, donor side in general, and the Afghan government side. I do not have a single case where a senior government official, either U.S. government or Afghan government, is brought to justice so that the rest of the corrupt enterprise that exists in places like Afghanistan be given lessons that if you go corrupt, there are repercussions. Now, what can be done really in terms of a realistic remedy for this huge problem?
I couldn't agree with you more, and my own disappointment in the U.S. government's lack of action in this regard is part of what drove me to write this book, because what I came to understand is that the calculus was wrong. U.S. government officials kept telling me later with corruption, first we have a security crisis, let us bring security to Afghanistan, and later we can deal with these secondary issues. I don't see it as a trade-off. On the contrary, I felt very strongly that without addressing the governance problem, you were never going to bring stability or security in a durable fashion to Afghanistan. And frankly, I lost that debate. And so that's part of why I wrote Thieves of State, was to try to make the argument even more strongly. As for what could have been done, the entire country was and practically remains on U.S. life support. So some of that life support could have been conditioned on different types of behavior on the part of the Afghan government. Rather than helping curb corruption, rather than helping the Afghan people establish rule of law, which was what I experienced their number one desire was, the United States government, inadvertently or not, ended up facilitating and enabling the development not just of ad hoc warlords who were skimming money where they could, but the development of what I see as quite a sophisticated and structured network of corruption that you could almost describe as a criminal network rather than a government. And this is an issue that just has not really been properly understood, I feel, by U.S. government officials. And the short-term imperatives of targeting bad guys trump the longer-term imperatives of ceasing to generate so many bad guys. So what could have been done? Financial assistance could have been conditioned. when the Minister of Religious Affairs, who was under a no-travel ban and had an indictment against him, was allowed to leave the country, there should have been repercussions against the Karzai administration for allowing this man to leave the country. When Kabul Bank almost collapsed and was bailed out of government funds, the International Monetary Fund should have maintained its hold on its program for Afghanistan until such time as its 9-point remedy program was actually fulfilled. That never happened. Indeed, the United States pushed the IMF to release its money.
But Sarah, excuse me if I interrupt you here.
Please.
When we talk about anti-corruption, we usually say, okay, let's punish these Afghan guys. But you also have to hear to them, you know, people like Karzai say, you Americans were the ones who brought corruption into Afghanistan. You are the ones that have institutionalized this menace in our government system. If you want to go serious about Afghan ministers, you want to bring them to justice, you have to also bring U.S. government contractors and all the enterprise into some sort of accountability so that, you know, you can mutually show your resolve that you're committed to this. But taking an Afghan government official out of his position or putting him in jail, I'm not sure that's going to work.
That's a little bit disingenuous on the part of President Karzai, given that he actually enjoys and was proud of enjoying the fact of being corrupted by the CIA. I mean, when it came out that the CIA pays him a certain number of millions of dollars every single month, he was not shy or embarrassed at taking that money. So indeed, it's certainly true that U.S. government actions are enabling and facilitating corruption in Afghanistan, and I just said that. But I think for President Karzai to hide behind that, while meanwhile he is doing everything he can to ensure the impunity of his own government officials who are guilty of corruption, which is what he did, that's a little bit of doublespeak. And in fact, in the case of the United States, there has been a little bit of effort to reduce the amount of waste and fraud and abuse in contracting. And you yourself mentioned the reports by the Special Inspector General, which have been incredibly powerful and well documented. And I haven't seen anything like that type of reporting coming out of the Afghan government. So while I agree with you that this is very much a two-way street, and while most of my effort is focused on changing the practices and the accountability of U.S. government officials, because I'm an American, I think that Karzai is not in a very good position to be throwing stones.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Sarah Chase. She's author of Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program are Akmal Dawi, Digital Managing Editor of VOA's Afghan Service, and Senior VOA Corruption Correspondent Jeffrey Young. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we love to hear from you. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. Tell us where you're from. Here's a shout out to Dalhatu Sab from Nigeria. Thanks for writing. Now let me turn to my colleague Jeffrey Young for a question.
Sarah, I think we have to look first off at the systemic flaw in the Afghan public sector. When you pay people ridiculously low salaries, policemen, building inspectors, whatever the case may be, this creates an endemic situation in which they are essentially compelled to extract money from the public just to be able to put food on their tables at home. This is a essential systemic flaw in, since we're talking about Afghanistan, there. But it's also true in many other countries.
Absolutely.
You have to pay people so that they don't need to take it out of other people's pocket. Are we in agreement?
Can I develop that a little bit?
Please do.
So one point is that, indeed, people in a position like that, be they police officers or teachers or doctors in the public health system in a number of these countries, are not paid sufficiently. But interestingly, they buy their positions. If you know that you're not going to be paid a living wage in the police, why would you purchase your position in the police department? And that happens in Uzbekistan, it happens in Nigeria, it happens in a number of these countries. Officials aren't just stealing people's money in order to put food on the table. They take these positions because they know that there's sort of no limit on how much they can steal. And the other side of that coin is that These governments, as I said before, are not actually governments. If they were performing really as governments, they would pay their public servants sufficiently to eat. They are functioning as essentially criminal organizations. The weaknesses in their government structures, like the underpaying of police officers or doctors, are deliberate because they want them to steal. Once they steal, they have to pay a cut of what they take up the line. So every police officer in Afghanistan, in Nigeria, in Uzbekistan is paying a portion of the shakedowns that they reap every day to their precinct captain, who pays some up to the district chief, and it goes on often all the way up to the minister. So if you look at some of the catastrophic failures in state power in a number of countries in the last couple of months, and by that I mean the Nigerian army facing Boko Haram, I mean the Ukrainian army facing the Russians on the east, I mean the Iraqi army facing ISIS. In each case, these armies had been hollowed out deliberately by the kleptocratic elites running the government, partly because they were afraid of the armies that might mount a coup, and partly because the military becomes a very important revenue stream. The United States was putting a huge amount of money, as you know better than I do, into the Iraqi military, and that became a revenue stream feeding the Maliki government. So these weaknesses are not accidental. They're not state failure. They're signs of successful criminal organizations running these governments.
Well, speaking of criminal organizations running governments, that certainly brings to mind Vladimir Putin in Russia. I wonder if you would address that, Sarah Chase. What's going on with Vladimir Putin's Russia, his invasion and annexation of Crimea, and, of course, the instability he has fostered in eastern Ukraine, which, notwithstanding Minsk agreements, seems to continue unabated?
I am not a Russia or an Eastern Europe specialist, so let me put a caveat right there. But let me take apart a piece of your question and point to the current situation of Ukraine, where you have ostensibly a reformer, Poroshenko. You have a very sophisticated civil society now in Ukraine that has emerged way back in the Orange Revolution, that has been growing more and more sophisticated and focused over the intervening years, and that has a number of its members actually in the Poroshenko government, really determined to make a change following this revolution, which is another kind of security event, right? But who's financing Poroshenko? Who paid for the refurbishing of the Ukraine army, which was discovered, as I just said, to be completely hollowed out, without munitions, without practically clothes on their back? Well, it turns out to be, in particular, one or a couple of the oligarchs, and in particular, one who owns a bank called the Privat Bank, which is being run essentially like a Ponzi scheme. So here's an example of where a change at the top, even a pretty promising one like in Ukraine, is not sufficient to root out the very structured nature of some of these networks. And these networks are, you asked about Russia, they are interpenetrated between Russia and the Russian-speaking side of Ukraine, and even potentially into some of the Ukrainian-speaking oligarchs. And so here's a place where, for example, the IMF could play a very important role, because Ukraine needs the IMF bailout. And so that gives the IMF leverage, and it could say, look, we will provide you the money you need, but here are some conditions. And among the conditions are, you have to clean up your banking sector. And that would make it much easier on Western capitals, who could say, hey, it's not us. This is the IMF speaking. This is a kind of faceless institution. So it takes some of the political weight off of Western leaders in their interactions with Poroshenko. This is the way that I suggest that some of the leverage that's held both by individual countries, by individual agencies within governments, and by multilateral organizations can be brought to bear simultaneously to bring about change.
A very good point. Well, let me turn now to Akmal for another question.
Sarah, we have this beast that's this huge corruption problem, not only in Afghanistan, and you have it elsewhere in the world. You're researching in Nigeria, you're researching and seeing it elsewhere in the world. And keeping in mind this global fight that now is focused on IS, back again in Iraq and to some extent in Syria, what is the solution? What is, you know, the remedy to reduce, if not eliminate, corruption in the U.S. engagement with the rest of the world in terms of fighting terrorism or in terms of developing these nascent democratic states?
Once an extreme security event has taken place, it's very difficult to get that evil genie back into the bottle. I think that it's a bit late to talk about addressing corruption in Iraq and Syria now. Mm-hmm. But even with respect to Iraq, I would have run the anti-IS campaign quite differently. What I would have said is I would have understood that the abusive corruption of the Maliki regime is a large factor in why such a significant swath of the Sunni population was willing to see IS as almost no worse than its own government. And I experienced that in Afghanistan when villagers would tell me, well, the Taliban hit me on this cheek and the government hits me on that cheek, where the population is caught in the crossfire between two very hostile forces. And for many of them, IS looked like at least the opportunity of change. So the U.S. government in facing IS, I believe, should have taken much more stock of that reality than it did. At least it conditioned its military support on a change at the top of the Iraqi government. But a change in one individual, as I've just described, is not going to change the system. So what I would have done is, rather than sending Secretary of State John Kerry around trying to create a military coalition with, frankly, many autocratic and kleptocratic governments like Bahrain, like Saudi Arabia, like some of the others, I would have sent Secretary of State Kerry to create an international force calling for a true political process for Iraq that would have really put on the table what are the legitimate grievances and aspirations of the Sunnis, what are the legitimate grievances and aspirations of the Kurds, and by that I mean not just the elites of those communities, but their populations too. And I would have conditioned military support for Abadi on his willingness to engage in that process, even if such a process were to lead to a much looser federation or even the breaking apart of the country, but to let that happen in a sort of rational process with rights and responsibilities being really hammered out in a peace process. That's how I would have used the thinking in Thieves of State to inform and inspire a very different approach to the IS crisis in Iraq and Syria. But the other thing that I'm urging in this book is to say, look, there are other countries that haven't experienced yet a severe security crisis, but you can imagine that they're likely to. And some of them might include Angola, Ethiopia, Uganda, Bulgaria, Central Asian countries. And in those countries, the United States and its Western partners would do well to think much harder about issues of governance and corruption upstream of when a crisis breaks out. And I would say Nigeria is a very interesting one where there is a security crisis, but the country hasn't imploded yet, but it might. And I find that the demonizing of Boko Haram exclusively, without really drawing attention to the massive theft of public resources that's going on at the top level of the Nigerian government, is irresponsible.
Well, Sarah, no question, the United States and a lot of other countries do not do preventative very well. But with respect to Nigeria, since we do have a large audience there, I'd like you to talk about that a bit more. And we have done many programs about that. Boko Haram is a terrible scourge, but the government is partially responsible for having fostered the growth of Boko Haram. So what other recommendations do you have for the United States or other countries vis-a-vis the Nigerian government?
The first point I'd like to make is simply that Boko Haram today, you know, has spun wildly out of control, as always happens once people are really pushed to extremes. So it's been manipulated, it's been captured. It's quite different from the original movement back in, you know, the early 2000s, whose emergence, I think, can clearly be tied to the corruption and abuse of the Nigerian government. The second really important point is that it's up to Nigerians to choose what kind of a future they want, what type of a government they want, embodying what type of ideals. But that said, I think the international community could do a much better job of helping Nigerian reformers when they do make an effort. So an example that I think is a really telling one is the former governor of the central bank, Back in 2013, he started noticing a significant shortfall in the oil revenues between the amount of oil that was being sold and the amount of money that was making it back into government coffers. And it was something like $20 billion over an 18-month period. And when he submitted a detailed memo about this with annexes and a lot of suggestions as to what the specific scams were and even what some of the banks were that might have been involved in moving some of that money, he got fired. And a few months later, Boko Haram kidnapped 250-something schoolgirls. A terrible act. But when the United States raised its voice about Boko Haram, it did not simultaneously ask any questions about why did you fire the governor of your central bank when he was only carrying out his fiduciary duties to figure out where Nigeria's national revenues were. And I feel that there's a lot more that the United States and the United Kingdom, whose prime minister has made corruption a central piece, at least of his public diplomacy, both the U.S. and the U.K. could do a lot more to dissuade Nigerian public officials from stealing this way, could make it harder for them to enjoy and safeguard their ill-gotten gains in our capitals. There are visas that could be denied. There are asset forfeiture cases that could be made. The United States government, for example, fairly recently made an asset forfeiture case against $485 million, I think, of Nigerian assets, but they were Abacha assets. That guy's dead,
yes.
You know? So the message that gets sent inadvertently is, you're okay, you can enjoy your assets in the United States so long as you're still in power, so long as you're still alive. And I think that's the wrong message to send.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the problems that we're seeing, the abdication of perhaps leadership, U.S. leadership.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that if the U.S. were a bit more active in that realm, it might encourage other reformers. For example, if there had been as loud a noise made over Sanusi's firing as was made over the kidnapped girls, then maybe other reformers would have rallied to his side and maybe it would have been more difficult to actually fire the guy.
The book is Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. The author, Sarah Chase. Well, Sarah, thank you for your time. Congratulations on your book, and we wish you all the best.
Thanks for the great questions.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Misha Dubinsky. Joining me on the program were Akmal Dawi, digital managing editor of VOA's Afghan service, and VOA corruption correspondent Jeffrey Young. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.